Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What adaptations allowed Mexicans to survive centuries of authoritarian rule and foreign control, and why are those adaptations holding the country back, even as it strengthens democracy and grows its middle class? My guest today is here to explore those questions and talk about how Mexico might position itself better for the future by encouraging more of its citizens to live and work abroad. Jorge Castañeda served as Mexico's foreign minister from 2000 until 2003. He is currently Global Distinguished Professor of Latin American Studies at New York University and author of the new book Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. Jorge, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about your audience here. You write at the beginning of the book that this is an attempt to explain Mexico to Mexicans and to Americans. Now, Americans might seem an obvious choice. Why do Mexicans need an explanation of their national character and traits?
Well, because, Chris, this is a long tradition in Mexico. In other words, people have been writing books about who we are, a little bit like Samuel Huntington's book about the United States. Mm-hmm. In Mexico for at least a century. There has been a certain scarcity of these books over the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years perhaps. In Mexico, we've been much more concentrated on what we need to do or we needed to do to attain a representative democracy, to open up the economy, now to reduce drug trafficking and violence and organized crime. Instead of asking us these more abstract questions, who are we and are what we have been for all these centuries still viable and a good idea today, given how much the country has changed? So I thought it was also a worthwhile endeavor for Mexicans and to start a conversation in Mexico about who and how we are.
And your analysis here is the product of three different lenses. You look at the classics, you look at the numbers, and you look at your own experience. Talk for a minute about how those sources of insight overlap and where they tend to differ from one another.
Well, they differ only in that there are some things which people like Octavio Paz wrote about in the 1940s, or American anthropologists like Oscar Lewis wrote about in that same period, and Mexican anthropologists like Manuel Gamio wrote as long as 100 years ago, which are no longer relevant because they have to do, for example, with how the Mexican peasant was or wanted to be or did not want to be, etc.,
yeah.
At a time when the country was still a rural country, and it's no longer the case. There are very few peasants left in Mexico. Most of them are either in Mexico City or in Los Angeles. So that's not where we're, that's no longer relevant. But most of the things these people said have now been, in a sense, corroborated by the immense amount of polling data, of census data, of surveys, of market studies that many different actors, many different people have carried out in Mexico over the last 20 years for electoral purposes, for business purposes, for sociological endeavors, what have you. We now have a lot of numbers to go by, which, of course, these writers didn't have. And it turns out that at least in the cases I mentioned, the four or five traits I refer to, they were actually quite right. They got it right, even though they were a little bit, they were sort of guessing. These were intuitions of theirs. And in my own case, Chris, many of these things are things that I have run into myself in a long career now of moving in and out of politics in Mexico, in and out of the country, traveling and teaching abroad, although I haven't really lived abroad for many, many years now. I haven't lived in the United States since 1992, 93. Nonetheless, this has given me the opportunity perhaps to see the forest more clearly than the trees and more clearly than many of my compatriots. And this also has led me to see, well, the classics were largely right, and the numbers bear them out, and what I have lived also confirms many of these things.
So, Jorge, one of the concerns you have about Mexico in the 21st century is this long tradition of acute individualism. Now, you define individualism in a somewhat different way than Americans might sort of throw the term around. Can you talk about what it means?
Well, as I point out, and this is something that many have already detected in Mexico, Chris, Mexican individualism is an individualism of the family, mm-hmm. of the nuclear family. It's not only me. It's me and my family. But it is acute and extreme and radical. The only thing I care about is me and my family, or me meaning my family. I don't care about my community. I don't care about the country at large. I don't care about even my extended family. I certainly don't care a whole lot about my city, my state. I care about me and my family. All I'm interested is in finding individual solutions to whatever problems I have, even if those problems are collective. The most obvious example of this, Chris, of course, is the one most Americans are familiar with, Mexican emigration to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, what does an immigrant do? He is finding an individual solution, individual meaning he and his family on many occasions, many cases, to a collective problem. The collective problem is we do not have enough high, well-paying jobs in Mexico to go around. That's a collective problem. It's a national problem. What's the solution for each Mexican? I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Since it happens to be feasible, if every Mexican had to swim across the Pacific Ocean instead of just swimming across the Rio Bravo, as we call it, or the Rio Grande, as you call it, might be a little more difficult. But since the individual solution exists, and Mexicans, we have a propensity for that individual solution, well, it's no surprise that so many choose it.
And to the extent that remittances back home are propping up entire communities where lots of people have left, that's not really collective action so much as sort of accidental that all of these remittances to individual families come together and sort of help a community.
Exactly, because they don't go to the community.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the wives or the sons or the mothers who happen to live there. They're not taxed. They're not sent to the mayor or to the water system or to the electric power system. They're sent from one individual to another individual. The community as a whole benefits from this, but only because all these people live in one community. But there is very, very, very little collective action in the remittance-receiving communities in relation to the money they receive. Each family manages its money on its own, period.
And how does that individualism and that individual action come into conflict with an emerging middle-class society?
Well, the first point I try to make in the first couple of chapters of this new book, Chris, Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans, is precisely that as now Mexico has become a majority middle-class society, it cannot continue to be so rapidly individualistic, because the whole point of being a middle-class society is that a majority of the population is pretty much the same. Everybody dresses the same, walks the same, goes to the same movies or sports events, lives in similar homes, drives similar cars, has similar television, and watches similar programs on similar television, etc.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do everything differently and on your own, it's not going to work. It clashes. It clashes in the way the inhabitants of Mexico City, the middle class, with a couple of very recent exceptions, do not use public transportation. Anybody who has a car uses it. Not because there isn't public transportation, but because I prefer to go in my car. You will say that a lot of Americans do this also, particularly in cities like Los Angeles, for example,
mm-hmm.
where public transportation is very recent and terrible. But if you compare with other cities in Latin America, like Sao Paulo, or like Santiago in Chile, or like Buenos Aires, you will see many middle-class individuals in the subway every morning and every afternoon. In Mexico City, you won't. But this has led to incredible congestion in the city, and is getting even worse, to the point where we're almost importing this. Chris, this is an incredible statistic. We're almost importing as much gasoline in Mexico as the crude oil we are exporting.
Wow. Another issue that you find problematic is Mexican culture's reluctance to engage in conflict. Talk about how that plays itself out in everyday life and how that same trait expresses itself in terms of the domestic and international political climate.
Well, this is a sort of very well-studied and well-detected trait of the Mexican national character dating long time back. Avoid confrontation, avoid conflict, avoid any type of verbal, physical, political, ideological, professional conflict or fight, because the outcome is always worse than the outcome of avoiding. Even the best outcome is not a good one, because if you win, then someone else is humiliated and defeated, and that other person will want to exact revenge at some point, and will. So even winning isn't really winning. So the best thing to do is to avoid any altercation of that sort, any conflict of that sort. Now that, as an individual reaction, is one thing. As a collective one, it's much more complicated, because, for example, a representative democracy, the way it's supposed to work and does work, is that people win and lose. Mm-hmm. There are candidates, there are parties, there are programs, there are platforms, and voters vote for one or vote for the other. And in every election and in every vote in Congress, there's a winner and a loser. And that's the way it should be. The only point is that the winners shouldn't always be the winners, and the losers shouldn't always be the losers. Mm-hmm. And the losers' rights should be protected. We have one of the states in Mexico today where there's more violence and more problems linked to the drug wars is the state of Michoacán, west of Mexico City, a large state, an emigrant sending state to the United States. And it is so prone to violence, and it's coming up with an election for governor next November, this November, that the three parties who normally hate each other, the left, the right, and the center, seriously considered, they finally didn't do it, although it still may happen again, they were seriously considered having a single candidate run for the office of governor. Hmm. Instead of having three, have just one, a consensus candidate, because they said things are so difficult in Michoacán that the best thing we can do is avoid a competition, avoid a conflict, avoid an election. Well, there's nothing more contrary to representative democracy than this idea, which, granted, didn't fly.
Yeah.
But it came up. Seriously, it was seriously discussed. So I think this is one reason why this attitude no longer functions. And, of course, it functions even less in the terms of competition in a market economy, which is what we have on the one hand, a market economy. But we don't have the competition that necessarily has to go with it, because we don't like competition in Mexico.
My guest this hour is Jorge Castañeda. He is former foreign minister of Mexico, currently global distinguished professor of Latin American studies at New York University. His new book is called Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You're welcome to join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jorge Castañeda. He is former foreign minister of Mexico, now global distinguished professor of Latin American studies at NYU. His new book is called Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Jorge, obviously there is history behind this assumption among many Mexicans that the risk of the fight itself is greater than the risk of nothing changing. Can you talk about some of the things that have played into the cultivation of this attitude that still exists in 2011?
Well, it works in many different ways, Chris, but one is that what really binds this country together is a sense of a common history. Mexico is an extraordinarily diverse country with different regions, climates, ethnic origins, religions, languages, etc. And what we've been able to construct as a nation over the past couple of hundred years has really been one that only existed from the 1930s onward and only with a sense of a shared history. So history is very important, not because we're obsessed with it in the abstract, but because this is what has worked. It's a little bit what people often refer to, the equivalent of what people refer to in the United States as the American creed. Mm-hmm. Americans don't have a common history, by definition, because they come from all different parts.
Yeah.
But they have a common creed. Well, we have tried to construct a common history. The problem is with it is that it's generally felt and studied and read by Mexican children and adults and everyone as a history of victims. Our common history is a history of having been victimized since time immemorial. The Aztecs victimized the other civilizations in central Mexico from the 11th or 12th century onward. The Spanish victimized all of the indigenous people, beginning with the Aztecs, who lived in Mexico when they arrived. Some Spanish victimized other Spanish more than others. Then when independence came along, the British and then the Americans victimized us by taking Texas away, then by taking California, etc. away. Then the French invaded us and tried and victimized us by occupying Mexico in the 1860s. Then the Americans victimized us again in 1914. And then some Mexicans victimized other Mexicans before, during, and after the revolution, and until very recently. So this obsession with history, which has a reason, there's a rationale to it, it's not just something we make up, also has a characteristic. And if you've had a history of being victimized, of being exploited, oppressed, of being taken advantage of systematically, then you continue to be fearful of the source of that victimization, which is everything that comes from outside. Outside what? Well, outside the country right now, but it can be also outside your community, outside your home, outside your family, outside, of course, the region, what have you. And this makes life very difficult in a country today, Mexico, which is one of the most open economies in the world, where one out of every nine Mexicans lives abroad, meaning in the United States, where there are more Americans living than in any other civilian Americans than in any other country in the world, roughly 1 million Americans reside in Mexico, mm-hmm. live here, not tourists, not daily crossovers, people who live in Mexico, 1 million Americans, a country that depends enormously on tourism, meaning on people who come from abroad. In that kind of country, to be so fearful of the foreign, of the alien, of the outside world, is very complicated, is very, very difficult, because it's too contradictory. The two things don't go together.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, in describing the me and my family above all others mentality of many Mexicans, you could just as easily have been speaking of modern Russians. Can any of this fatal individualism, Bill asks, be traced back to having lived in a socialist state?
Well, I other than the fact that my mother was partly Russian, she came from a part of the world which was at some point sometimes was Russian, sometimes was Polish, sometimes was Lithuanian, and today is part of Belarus. Aside from that, I have very little knowledge of the Russian family, so I would not be able to compare. What I do know is that this individualism of the family, this radical individualism of the family in Mexico, predates the PRI authoritarian political system. Mm-hmm. It goes back way before. It goes back to the colonial period, at least, when there was a tendency for families to regroup and find an individual solution for the family to the problem of hunger, no land, etc. This is certainly not something which sprang up during the period of authoritarian rule in Mexico.
Another thing, another legacy of hundreds of years of authoritarian rule is that people are reluctant to fully engage in representative democracy, even when it exists. Even when the government is not corrupt, people tend not to trust it. And this is a real stumbling block at this point in Mexico's history.
Well, we have been traditionally and rightly mistrustful of government, of the justice system, of the Congress, of the press, of everything, because this, yes, as a result of the last 80 years of authoritarian rule before the year 2000, we did not have any of these things in a way that was a functioning way and that was accessible to people. Access to justice in Mexico is something that even today does not really exist for most people.
Mm-hmm.
Very few crimes, less than 5% of the crimes committed in Mexico are reported to the police because people don't trust the police, and they're right not to trust the police.
Yeah.
And the very few crimes are then processed in the legal system, in the justice system, because people don't trust the justice system, and to a large extent, they're right in not trusting it. Now, how do you rebuild? How do you build something which didn't exist before? Well, it's not a simple thing. I point out in this book, in my book, Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans, that establishing the rule of law in a country that has an incredible disregard for the law, but for rational and coherent reasons, not stupidly, not selfishly, not blindly, but
sure,
for
you're
good
gonna,
reasons.
You're going to buck against a corrupt government or corrupt law enforcement.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you go around it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for people like that, how to construct the rule of law is not simple. But I also think not only that it's decisive, but that it could become the new, as the Big Lebowski would say, the new rug that ties the room together.
Yeah.
And we need a new rug because the old one, the historical one, doesn't work anymore.
Well, how do you even begin to sort of talk people into this concept that, yes, in the past when you had extremely corrupt government that it made sense to go around the law, but today laws as simple as things like consumer protections and traffic laws are actually enacted to protect people, and skirting them hurts people more than it helps?
Well, first of all, you have to make an enormous educational effort, and I don't mean in schools only, although schools are important,
mm-hmm.
but you have to make an enormous educational effort from government, from the media, from the private sector, from civil society to move in this direction. For example, it took us forever to adopt legislation which allows class action suits or collective action, class action suits for consumer affairs and for environmental affairs. This was just approved. The final legislation was approved barely 2 months ago, and it's still not in force. We're the last country in Latin America to have done this. Once we have this, and once this is socialized, you create an incentive for people, hopefully, to come together, to unite in a small group or a big group, it doesn't matter, and sue a company or the government or anybody, a business, because they were mistreating them or betraying their rights or refusing them rights that they have. And then when this works, if it does, and it's a big if, then other people will see that, yes, actually, if you do things like this, you get somewhere. But this requires an enormous effort of propaganda, of cultural transformation, of understanding how things have to change in the Mexican mindset, not only in Mexican laws, because if you change the laws, but people don't use the new laws, then it's useless. It goes nowhere. And that's a little bit what I get into in the last chapter of the book, Chris.
One of the things, you know, you can have good laws and you can have good lawmakers, but if people enforcing the laws are corrupt, you really get nowhere. And of course, not every law is enforced by people like the police, but that is a long-standing problem. And it seems like just when you have someone coming in saying, we're going to clean up this law enforcement agency, you hear very soon that they've been coerced into behaving badly. What do we do about that problem specifically?
Well, many of us in Mexico, not just in this book, Mañana Forever, but elsewhere, in other books in my case, and many other people have been saying, for example, regarding the police, we copied the U.S. police system, which is a very decentralized, federalized police system. You have county police or city police in the United States, and then you have state police. You practically have no federal police. All you have is the FBI.
Right.
Which is a very small and purely investigative police, as its name says. For practical purposes, there are no national police in the United States. When there's a riot or a problem that goes beyond the capability of the county police or the state police anywhere in the United States, the president has no choice but to use the National Guard or the Army. There's nothing else.
Right.
Okay. We copied this in Mexico, and of course it didn't work. It never worked.
Mm-hmm.
What we should have done is something that other countries in Latin America and Europe have done, which is to have a highly centralized national police. Because given the dispersion of Mexican communities and everything, the local police will never have the training, the equipment, the organization, the internal affairs department, etc., necessary to both be effective and honest, the two things. What we suggest, many people are suggesting now, is we should just get rid of the municipal police, about 350,000 of them, which are useless. Get rid of the state police, about 100,000, which are also pretty useless, and build on the existing national police, which is very small, has about 20,000 people and troops in it. Build on that to have a large national police force, like in Chile, like in Colombia, like in Canada, with the exception of Ontario and Quebec, granted the two largest provinces, and like several countries in Western Europe, that only with a national police will we be able eventually to instill trust in the people, that people have trust in their police, that instead of fearing the police, Mexicans respect and trust the police as a solution to their problems, not as being part of the problem.
Well, going back to the example of Colombia, I think that's really interesting that you brought that up, Jorge, because certainly Colombia and its drug problems were similar a couple of decades ago to what Mexico is really in anguish over today. Did they find in Colombia that, in fact, a really strong, highly centralized national police force was inherently less susceptible to corruption of officers on an individual basis than local officers?
Less so, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Not totally, but less than the alternative, absolutely. And one of the important factors in the success that Colombia has encountered lies precisely in having had a national police force on which to build. It was created in the 1940s. It wasn't created now. But since they had it, they could build on it instead of having to invent it or to depend on local police. Now, the Colombian case is very interesting, Chris, and I'm glad you pointed out, but there is one fundamental difference with Mexico, and Colombia has been very skillful in exploiting this difference, but it's not entirely a truthful picture of what has happened. Colombia had a huge guerrilla threat from the FARC and to a lesser extent from the ELN dating back to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
What Colombia has been greatly successful in doing the last 10 years is fighting and almost defeating the guerrilla groups who had links with the drug organizations, lived off their association with the drug organizations, and were responsible for the violence in Colombia. So if Colombia reduced the violence, nearly defeated the guerrillas, but has not reduced its drug shipments to the United States or the surface of coca leaf acres under cultivation. That it hasn't done.
Hmm.
What it did do was defeat the guerrillas and reduce violence. We don't have guerrillas in Mexico.
Yeah.
And so we can't beat them. We can't defeat them. There's nobody to defeat.
Let's talk about this. We will get in the next segment into what you see as some of the solutions to these problems we're describing. But the last thing I want to discuss here is something that might occur to people as being much more subtle than the other things we've talked about. And that is the reluctance of many Mexicans, as you describe it, to fully express their emotions and their aspirations. What's behind that? And what is the larger impact on the ability of Mexico to really function well and to prosper in the 21st century?
Well, a lot has to do here with the question of competition. I give the example in the book of this obsession we have, as was pointed out by the New York Times, but then analyzed by Mexican political scientists, with the Guinness Book of World Records. There's no country in the world as obsessed with the Guinness Book of World Records as Mexico. The New York Times said, if there were a record for the most obsessed country with the Guinness Book of World Records, it would be Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We build the largest we cook the largest taco, the largest tamal. We have the tallest artificial Christmas tree, the largest ice skating rink, the largest number of people kissing in the one place, in one public square at any one time. And most importantly, in recent years, of course, the largest number of people simultaneously and together dancing to Michael Jackson's Thriller. It's a very important record, really fundamental. Why do this? So a Mexican political scientist asked himself, why is this so?
Right.
There's no question that it is so, but why? And his answer was very perceptive, very insightful, because this is the kind of competition we Mexicans love.
Hmm.
Why do we love it? Because there's no competitors.
Nobody gets hurt if you win.
Nobody gets hurt. There's only one person competing, Mexico.
Hmm.
Nobody else is going to do something so foolish. So we're the only ones competing, so we win by definition. And so nobody gets hurt. Nobody loses. Nobody's humiliated. Nobody wants revenge. You don't have a problem. Well, this attitude towards competition is what has led, for example, to the wealthiest individual in the world being Mexican.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest this hour is Jorge Castañeda. He is former foreign minister of Mexico. His new book is called Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. You can get to us by sending email to think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Foreign Minister of Mexico, now Global Distinguished Professor of Latin American Studies at New York University, Jorge Castañeda. His new book is called Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Jorge, before the break, you were leading up to a discussion of the richest human being in the world, or at least on the top five list, certainly every single year, and that is Carlos Slim.
Yes, Chris, and while, you know, I think this is a marvelous achievement for him and for Mexico, and we should be proud of the fact that there is a Mexican businessman who is so skillful and so successful and so competitive that he has become most of the time the world's most wealthiest individual, it's also true that this shows that the concentration of wealth and power in Mexico is enormous. And has been for the past 200 years or more. I provide some just numbers in the book showing how the concentration of land, of property of land, of ownership of land, as early as the 18th century, and clearly at the beginning of the 19th century, was much greater in Mexico than anywhere else in Latin America, let alone in the United States. So it's not that Carlos Slim right now takes advantage of a certain situation. That's his business to do that, and he does so very well, and he all the best to him. It's that the country and the society and the laws and the institutions do not enforce competition in a way that spreads wealth around more equally. This is also why Mexico is one of the most unequal societies in the world, although things have been improving in the last few years.
So one of the things you see as a sign of hope for Mexico is the fact that so many Mexicans, as we referred to earlier, are living and working in the United States. Can you talk about what influence the U.S. has on Mexicans who come to live and work here, and then what they export back to home?
Well, it's really two separate arguments, Chris. One is that if we want to ask ourselves the question, can Mexicans change our mindset? Is this something that is possible, or is it so unlikely, so far-fetched, so far removed that it's meaningless? Mm-hmm. Well, what I say is we have a sort of Petri dish, real-time experiment going on where we can see if this is true or not. And these are the roughly 11 or 12 million Mexicans, of which about 80% must have arrived over the last 15 years in the United States. Who have been uprooted, placed in a different context, in a different environment, do they become different or don't they? That's the first point. Do they or do they not? And my answer is yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if they do, is there a way for them to influence behavior back home, their families back home, their friends back home, their community back home? Or do they become so estranged, so removed from their previous life, that even though they change, the changes they experience are meaningless back home? And I say that the jury is out on that one, but that there is hope that it could happen, depending on all sorts of factors which right now are difficult to foresee.
Does it take a certain percentage of those immigrants to actually go and reside permanently back in Mexico after a stint in the United States?
Well, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the sort of
historically
pipe dream,
it hasn't happened. Yeah,
the pipe dream that of some American conservatives have, that maybe they can just throw all the Mexicans out, or if the recession is sufficiently deep and tough laws are sufficiently enforced, Mexicans will go back. That's not going to happen. It never did, and it won't now. And the United States is no longer able, thank God, to implement policies such as what was called Operation Wetback back in 1951 and 52, when hundreds of thousands of Mexicans were forcibly deported. That's not going to happen. And Mexicans are not going to go back peacefully, so that's not going to happen either. Okay. Now, the next point is, what kind of contact can there be between Mexicans in the United States and Mexicans in Mexico? Traditionally, what happened, Chris, is that people would come and go. People would go from Mexico, work in the United States for 3 months or 6 months of year, come back to Mexico. Do the same thing the following year, third year, the fourth year, and some of them would eventually start staying in the United States, which is why there is such a large Mexican-American community in the United States, which will soon be the largest minority in the United States. The Latinos are already the largest, but they're not all Mexican-American.
Mm-hmm.
But Mexican-Americans will very soon be the largest minority in the United States. That circularity, as it was called, was interrupted by Clinton, Bush, and Obama immigration policies, which did not deter Mexicans from going to the United States, but made it more costly and dangerous. And by making it more costly and dangerous, instead of coming and going, you just stay in the United States, period.
Because you don't want to risk, first of all, your personal safety, but then the ability to get back when the job picks up again in the United States.
Exactly, and you have to pay the pollero, the smuggler, another $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 to get you in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very rational reaction by Mexicans. They say, well, okay, if you don't allow us to come and go as easily as before, it's not that we're going to stop going to the United States. What's going to happen is that we're going to start staying in the United States. And that's the reason for the explosion in the number of Mexicans in the United States over the last 15 years. So, okay, that means that part of contact has been reduced. But I think it's been compensated, Chris, by the enormous amount of communication that goes on between Mexicans in the United States and Mexicans back home, not only in terms of remittances, but in terms of phone calls, in terms of Twitter, in terms of Facebook, in terms of SMSs, all of which are incredibly cheap now in the United States, with all sorts of different phone cards like IDT and others, you can spend hours and hours and hours speaking with your family or your friends in Mexico for practically nothing, let alone, of course, what you do on Facebook or through your phone on SMS or Twitter. And Mexicans in the United States, especially Mexican women, and this is one of the most hopeful signs of all of this, have access to this. And they can send even a phone card to their folks back in Mexico so they can call them also. Or they can do it by Skype, Skyping. So if you put all of this together, the communication that goes on every day is enormous. It's really mind-boggling, even if circularity has been curtailed because of what I consider to be these mistaken American immigration policies.
Well, Jorge, is that constant contact having a demonstrable effect on the xenophobia within Mexico that you described earlier, given that, as you mentioned, Mexico is a very diverse country, but in a different way than the United States? If a Mexican immigrant is living in a large U.S. city, he or she is likely to encounter people from all over the world as neighbors and coworkers.
Well, it certainly has a the change is very visible among Mexicans in the United States, and we now know more about them. We have surveys, we have polling data, we have studies, we have the U.S. Census Bureau. We know we have studies of attitudes. We know much more about Mexican citizens in the United States. I'm not referring to Mexican Americans.
Right.
Mexican citizens in the United States. We know much more about them today than we did 20 or 30 years ago. And we know more about their attitudes and consequently about their points of view regarding others, Americans, Central Americans, Asians, African Americans, and I think little by little you begin to see a change. The change is not so substantial in this area as it is in others, which I describe in Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans, particularly regarding Mexican women in the United States, which is where I think the transformational experience is most important, is greatest, and can have the greatest impact in the long term.
So that women, Mexican women who move to this country recognize a different role for American women than they have seen back home?
Exactly, and they have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
One could say they're free riders, perhaps, Chris, in the sense that they were not part of the struggle of American women to obtain the freedoms, the equality, the achievements that they have conquered over the last 30 years, despite still a series of obstacles that exist. But all of these benefits are available to Mexican women, even if they didn't really participate in that struggle. And other benefits are also. But the main one, of course, is that Mexican women, once they come to the United States, particularly if they come alone, but even if they come with the husband or the boyfriend or the father, they can get their own jobs, earn very well, better in most cases than the men do, and not depend on the men or have any be accountable to the men. They can just tell the men to go fly a kite, and they'll live alone or with friends, and they will keep their money or do whatever they want to do with their money, spend it any way they want to spend it, and work the hours they want to work, and not have to stay at home and take care of the children, the husband, the boyfriend, the father, the grandfather, and the husband or boyfriend's friends, buddies. They send all that to hell, and they achieve a degree of independence and a degree of self-respect that women in Mexico do not often have. And this is an enormous transformation, which you can see in the polls, you can see in the attitudes of Mexican women in the United States, how they live, how they dress, how they go out dancing Saturday night, how they work. It's very visible, obviously more so in the cities than in the countryside, obviously more for younger women than older ones, obviously more for women coming from urban areas in Mexico than from rural areas in Mexico. But it's a huge change anyway.
Let's go quickly to the phones here, and we'll speak with Rose in Plano. Hi, Rose.
Hi. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Castaneda. And my question is, in view of the fact that so many Mexican people have come here over the past 100 years or so and worked here, why hasn't the Mexican government done something to harness that intelligence and that energy into higher technology. For example, what I'm getting at is the United States hands out visas and green cards to people from India and Pakistan and other countries of the world to come here and work in technology. And why hasn't Mexico tried to harness that? And by the way, I'm the daughter of one of those Mexicans that was forcibly deported in 1951. And I've had this question for a long time. Why do the Mexican laborers have to come here and labor? Why not harness that energy? And thank you. I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call. What do you think?
Thank you. Well, I think it's a very good question, and there's no good answer for it. There's a problem of educational levels. Mexico has, of course, a much higher educational level than India does, but the Mexicans who go to the United States because it's so much easier to go than from India don't tend to be the ones who have the engineering degrees, whereas many of the Indians who go to the United States and get these visas that Rose was speaking about quite rightly are extraordinarily well-trained engineers who can only obtain very poorly paid jobs in India, and so prefer, or doctors from India who prefer to go to the United States, and because they're highly skilled, they give visas to them. The U.S. gives them visas. The United States gives a very small number, about 70 or 80,000 visas a year, to unskilled, low-wage Mexican labor, the H-2As and H-2B visas, which are a very small number, given the amount of people that come, given the fact that Mexico is right next to the United States. See, this is something we always have to remember. There's no other country in the world that's next to the United States, with the exception, of course, of Canada, which has a standard of living which is even higher, perhaps, than that of the United States. So although there are some Canadians who work illegally in the United States, there are also some Americans who work illegally in Canada. Mm-hmm. Because the two countries have roughly the same standard of living, maybe Canada even higher. That's not the case with Mexico. And so, yes, you will have a lot of people from Mexico going to the U.S. for low-skill, low-wage labor, which doesn't really, is not, at those, in that type of market, there's just not good jobs available in Mexico. You can make a Mexican housekeeper in New York City can make over $20 an hour. And she or he can have a couple, 2 to 3 shifts a day, 6 days a week. I would say this is low-skill labor because you have to know how to do this, but it's not, certainly not the labor that requires a PhD.
Yeah.
You can't make that money in Mexico.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time. Jorge Castañeda served as Mexico's foreign minister from 2000 until 2003. He is Global Distinguished Professor of Latin American Studies at NYU now and author of the new book, Mañana Forever, Mexico and the Mexicans. Jorge, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.